soldiers of the Yadu dynasty, commanded by Balaram himself, broke the whole strength of Rukmi's army, just as an elephant in a tank discards the feeble stem of a lotus flower. In other words, as an elephant breaks the whole construction of a lotus flower while bathing in a reservoir of water, the military strength of the Yadus broke up Rukmi's forces. When the commanders of the Yadu dynasty came back to see Krishna, they were all surprised to see the condition of Rukmi. Lord Balaram became especially compassionate for his sister-in-law, who was newly married to his brother. To please Rukmini, Balaram personally untied Rukmini, and to further please her, Balaram, as the elder brother of Krishna, spoke some words of chastisement. Krishna, your action is not at all satisfactory. He said, this is an abomination very much contrary to our family tradition. To cut someone's hair and shave his mustache and beard is almost comparable to killing him. Whatever Rukmi might have been, he is now our brother-in-law, a relative of our family, and you should not have put him in such a condition. After this, to pacify Rukmini, Lord Balaram said to her, you should not be sorry that your brother has been made odd-looking. Everyone suffers or enjoys the results of his own actions. Lord Balaram wanted to impress upon Rukmini that she should not have been sorry for the consequences her brother suffered, due to his actions. There was no need of being too affectionate towards such a brother. Lord Balaram again turned toward Krishna and said, my dear Krishna, a relative, even though he commits such a blunder and deserves to be killed, should be excused. For when such a relative is conscious of his own fault, that consciousness itself is like death. Therefore, there is no need to kill him. Balaram again turned toward Rukmini and informed her that the current duty of a kshatriya in human society is so fixed that, according to the principles of fighting, one's own brother may become an enemy. When a kshatriya does not hesitate to kill his own brother. In other words, Lord Balaram wanted to instruct Rukmini that Rukmi and Krishna were right in not showing mercy to each other in the fighting, despite the family consideration that they happen to be brothers-in-law. Sri Balaram informed Rukmini that kshatriyas are typical emblems of the materialistic way of life. They become puffed up whenever there is a question of material acquisition. Therefore, when there is a fight between two belligerent kshatriyas for kingdom, land, wealth, women, prestige, and power, they try to put one another into the most abominable condition. Balaram instructed Rukmini that her affection towards her brother Rukmi, who had created enmity with so many persons, was a perverse consideration befitting an ordinary materialist. Her brother's character was not at all admirable, considering his treatment towards other friends, and yet Rukmini, as an ordinary woman, was affectionate toward him. He was not fit to be her brother, and still Rukmini was lenient toward him. Besides that, Balaram continued, the consideration that a person is neutral or is one's friend or enemy is generally made by persons in the bodily concept of life. Such foolish persons are bewildered by the illusory energy of the Supreme Lord. The spirit soul is the same pure quality in any embodiment of matter, but those who are not sufficiently intelligent see only the bodily differences between animals and men, literates and illiterates, rich and poor, which cover the pure spirit soul. Such differences, observed merely on the basis of the body, are exactly like the differences between fires in terms of the various types of fuel they consume. Whatever the size and shape of the fuel, there is no such variety of size and shape in the fire which comes out. Similarly, in the sky, there are no differences in size and shape. In this way, Balaram appeased them by his moral and ethical instructions. He stated further, this body is part of the material manifestation. The living entity, or spirit soul, being in contact with matter, is transmigrating due to illusory enjoyment from one body to another, and that transmigration is known as material existence. This contact of the living entity with the material manifestation has neither integration nor disintegration. My dear chaste daughter-in-law, the spirit soul is, of course, the cause of this material body. Just as the sun is the cause of sunlight, eyesight, and the forms of material manifestation. The example of the sunshine and the material manifestation is very appropriate in understanding the living entity's contact with the material world. In the morning, the sun rises, and the heat and light gradually expand throughout the whole day. The The sun is the cause of all material shapes and forms, for it is due to the sun the integration and disintegration of material elements take place. But as soon as the sun sets, the whole manifestation is no longer connected to the sun, which has passed away from one place to another. When the sun passes from the eastern to the western hemisphere, the results of the interactions due to the sunshine in the eastern hemisphere remain, but the sunshine itself is visible again in the western hemisphere. Similarly, the living entity accepts or produces different bodies and different bodily relationships in particular circumstance. But as soon as he gives up the present body and accepts another, he has nothing to do with the former body. Similarly, the living entity has nothing to do with the next body he accepts. He is always free from the contact of this bodily contamination. Therefore, the appearance and disappearance of the body have nothing to do with the living entity, just as the waxing and waning of the moon have nothing to do with the moon. When the moon waxes, we falsely think that the moon is developing, and when it wanes, we think that the moon is decreasing. Actually, the moon, as it is always the same. It has nothing to do with the visible activities of waxing and waning. Consciousness of material existence can be compared to sleeping and dreaming. When a man dreams, he dreams of many non-factual happenings, and as a result of dreaming, he becomes subject to different kinds of distress and happiness. Similarly, when a person is in the dream of material consciousness, he suffers the effects of accepting a body and giving it up again in material existence. Opposite to this material consciousness is Krishna consciousness. In other words, when a man is elevated to the platform of Krishna consciousness, he becomes free from the false conception of life. So, Balaram is instructing his sister, or rather, his sister-in-law, Rukmini, not to lament the condition of her brother, who was attached to the bodily concept of life. The pain and pleasure that we experience in this material world is simply due to false identification, the false ego. Actually, the spirit soul is transcendental to this material body, but only due to the strong identification with the body do we experience so-called happiness and distress, pleasure and pain. This false ego is very strong. Actually, as we hear in Bhagavad Gita, the soul, it cannot be cut by any weapon. It can't be weathered by the wind. It can't be burned by fire. In one sense, the soul is always transcendental to the material conception of life, to the body. The soul doesn't really come into contact with matter. Well, how is it then that we experience the so-called pleasure of this material body and the pain? It's very real. Especially the pain is very real. Today we went to see Mother Vilasini, who's suffering from some form of cancer, and she was explaining some of the tests that she was going through, which were quite painful. So how is it that if the soul is transcendental to the body and has no contact with the body, we feel the pain and the pleasure of the material body? This is due to the false ego only, because we strongly identify with matter. We experience these things. So how to become transcendental? We have to hear how we're not the body over and over and over again, and identify ourselves as spirit soul. Then we can transcend such situations. An example of how strong the false ego is may be seen in one's extended bodily attachments. For example, we have this particular body, but we have many bodily attachments as well. We identify with them just as strongly. For example, we have our family members, and we have our material possessions, and these things, in one sense, are as dear to us as life, because they are the means by which we enjoy the sense gratification of the body. Prabhupada describes it as extended selfishness. Of course, we're speaking of materialists, not devotees. But to have a material body means to experience one's selfish desire separate from Krishna. And that's extended through the medium of one's immediate family members. Pumsha studiya mituni bhavam tayor mito hidaya granti maho. Maho, we accept this attempt to be tired. Janasi maho yam hamameti. the material conception of life means my body, my wife, my husband, my children, my household paraphernalia, etc., etc. So one identifies with these things also as part of his plan for material enjoyment. So let us take, for example, part of that, one's car. So obviously the driver and the vehicle, there's no intimate relationship. The vehicle is simply a machine, and the machine is moving because of the presence of the driver only. So let us say that there's some accident. So as soon as there's an accident, then the person who's driving the car, he experiences great grief because the car has been damaged. Actually, it has nothing to do with the car. It's simply a machine. Because he very strongly identifies, because he's very attached to that machine, as soon as there's some dent or the paint is rubbed off or there's in some way the car is damaged, then it's just as if his own body had been damaged, because he so strongly identifies. In the same way, he's very proud, he becomes puffed up when the car is looking very nice and it's very shiny, etc., etc. So this is an illusion. When his car is smashed, he's feeling some pain. But when the car is nice, then he's also feeling elated. But this is an illusion. So similarly, this body is called in Sanskrit yantra. Yantra means machine. It's a very, very sophisticated machine. And the driver is the living entity. And because the driver identifies so strongly with the matter, then he experiences the pain and pleasure of material existence. So how to become free from the false concept of material plane and material pleasure? We have to become convinced that we are not the body, but we are the soul inside. Of course, so many times we've heard that we are not the body, but to actually have vigyan, or realized knowledge, is the result of practicing devotional service, becoming purified. The knowledge is there, but the vigyan, or the realization, comes as a result of performing devotional service. And we can understand that we're making some progress or some advancement in Krishna consciousness when we're no longer disturbed by the demands of the body. Vacha vegam, manasa krodha vegam, jiva vegam. The body is always proposing so many things, making so many demands. And one who can control those demands of the body is called Goswami, or Swami. Swami means one who controls, and go means senses. So one who can control the demands of the senses, it's to be understood that he's rising above the bodily concept of life, because the body is made to impose demands upon us. So we can see, we can judge our advancement in Krishna consciousness. One way to judge our advancement in Krishna consciousness is that when we feel the pushings of the senses, that we can control that. We don't surrender. Actually, we use our intelligence. Krishna says, above the senses, or the body, is the mind, and above the mind is the intelligence. So the body is making demands based on what? The mind's desires. The mind has very many desires as a result of associating with this material energy. Prabhupada said, sometimes just like bubbles appear in the ocean, apparently from nowhere. And actually, there's mud at the bottom of the ocean. So when that mud is disturbed, so many little bubbles are coming up, hundreds and millions of them. So similarly, within the mind, due to the association with this material nature, Prabhupada said there's unlimited desires. The mind is something like a camera, and many shots of, or pictures have been taken. And because the mind is part of the subtle body, it continues with this life after life. That's why sometimes at night we may dream of something very strange, something that we haven't seen in this lifetime. But Prabhupada said it may be because the mind has taken that picture of that experience in a previous lifetime. Like he says, for example, someone may dream that he's flying. Anyone had that dream? I had that dream. We dream that we're flying. And Prabhupada said that this dream is there because in previous lifetime, perhaps one was demigod. So if you said yes, that means you were demigod. But the mind is tricky, because sometimes the mind is seeing gold, it's seeing mountain, is putting the combination together, and it's appearing as a golden mountain. So sometimes the mind is producing so much nonsense also. But as a result of that, so many pictures are there. They're stored within our memory. And sometimes they're becoming just like bubbles are coming in the ocean. Just some little agitation is there, and so many bubbles are coming. So similarly, the mind is constantly being disturbed by so many impressions of material existence. And this produces desires there. And our nature is to act on those desires. But the advantage that we have is that above the mind is the intelligence. And the intelligence can decide what is good or bad. Of course, animals, they don't have this facility. So whenever desire is there, they simply act on it. There's no question of considering what is the result of that action. They simply act, and the result is there, be it good or bad. But a human being, he has superior intelligence. He can discern the result, the end result of that activity. He can see. Actually, our intelligence, I was listening to a tape recently, Prabhupada said with the intelligence, one actually has mystic power. One mystic power is that one can see past, present, and future. That is a mystic power. If one has mystic power, he can see into the past, and he can also predict the future. So the mind, Prabhupada said, also has this mystic ability to be able to see into the future. In what way can the mind see into the future? Well, the mind, or rather the intelligence, see into the future. Well, the intelligence can see. He can contemplate what will be the end result of this particular activity. He may consider that if I become attached to this particular material object, then what will the future be, being attached to this object? For example, someone may be attached, a woman may be attached to a man, or a man may become attached to a woman. They may become absorbed in that consciousness and a mood of lust or whatever. But with the intelligence, we can see what will the end result be of that illicit connection. This is the power of the mind, or the intelligence. We can use this facility, just like we may, even as devotees, when we become attached improperly to some, the mind may dwell on some sense gratification. But the mind can take us to the future very quickly. The boy may be thinking, this girl is very beautiful. But with the intelligence, we can go many years in the future and we can see that she's no longer so attractive. It's like a video. You can be watching a video, and then the story is there, but if you push the fast forward button, and you let go, then you can see what the result of the story will be. So in the same way, one trick that we can use with our intelligence, if we become unduly attached to something, irreligiously or illicitly, let us say, then with our mind, we see, oh, it's no longer so attractive. Of course, if you do that with Krishna, Krishna becomes even more attractive. Krishna's beauty is always increasing. But in the material concept of life, we can see, we can fast forward and we can appreciate that actually everything in this material world, the beauty fades in due course of time. So with our intelligence, we can appreciate like that, that the soul is always transcendental to the material concept of life, and therefore we should not become attached. And if attachment is there, then we have to hear again and again how we are not the body, and we have to act on the platform of spirit, soul, and Krishna consciousness, and gradually we'll become detached. And again, one sign of detachment is that when the attraction is there, we can control it. So if anyone has, if we contemplate even for a moment some sense gratification, then that means that we're not beyond the bodily concept of life. We may think, let me hear more intimate pastimes, let me go to higher levels of Krishna consciousness. But actually, one who has material desire should not go so deeply into those pastimes until he's conquered his material desires. So if one is honest with himself, he can understand that if there's some attraction there, if the mind dwells even for a moment on something material, that means that we still think that we can be satisfied by acting through this body, the sense gratification. So we have to transcend. So this, some of Balaram's teachings to Princess Rukmini. In this way, Sri Balaram instructed Rukmini and Krishna in spiritual knowledge. He addressed his sister-in-law thus, "Sweet, smiling Rukmini, do not be aggrieved by false motives caused by ignorance. Only because of false notions does one become unhappy. But one can immediately remove this unhappiness by discussing the philosophy of actual life. Be happy on that platform only." By hearing such enlightening instructions from Sri Balaram, Rukmini immediately became pacified and happy and adjusted in her mind, which was very much afflicted by the degraded position of her brother Rukmi. As far as Rukmi was concerned, his promise was not fulfilled, nor was his mission successful. He had come from home with his soldiers and military phalanx to defeat Krishna and release his sister. But on the contrary, he lost all his soldiers and military strength. He was personally degraded and very sorry, but by the grace of the Lord, he could continue his life to its fixed destination. Because he was a Kshatriya, he could remember his promise that he would not return to his capital city, Kundina, without killing Krishna and releasing his sister, which he had failed to do. Therefore, he decided in anger not to return to his capital city, and he constructed a small cottage in the village known as Bhojakata, where he began to reside for the rest of his life. For one who has been honored, dishonor is worse than death. After defeating all the opposing elements and forcefully carrying away Rukmini, Krishna brought her to his capital city, Dwarka, and then married her according to the Vedic ritualistic principle. After this marriage, Krishna became the king of the Yadavas at Dwarka. On the occasion of his marriage with Rukmini, all the inhabitants were very happy, and in every house there were great ceremonies. The inhabitants of Dwarka city were so pleased that they dressed themselves with the nicest possible ornaments and garments and went to present gifts according to their means to the newly married couple, Krishna and Rukmini. All the houses of Yadupuri. All the houses of Yadupuri, Dwarka, were decorated with flags, festoons, and flowers. Each and every house had an extra gate specifically prepared for this occasion, and on both sides of the gate were big water jugs filled with water. The whole city was flavored by the burning of fine incense, and at night there was illumination from thousands of lamps decorating every building. The entire city appeared jubilant on the occasion of Lord Krishna's marriage with Rukmini. Everywhere in the city there were profuse decorations of banana trees and betel nut trees. These two trees are considered very auspicious and happy ceremonies. At the same time, there was an assembly of many elephants who carried the respective kings of different friendly kingdoms. It is the habit of the elephant that whenever he sees some small plant and trees, out of his sportive and frivolous nature, he uproots the trees and throws them hither and thither. The elephants assembled on this occasion also scattered the banana and betel nut trees. But in spite of such intoxicated action, the whole city, with the trees thrown here and there, looked very nice. The friendly kings of the Kurus and the Pandavas were represented by Bhishma, Dhritarashtra, the five Pandu brothers, King Drupada, King Shantardhanya, and Rukmini's father, Bhishmaka. Because of Krishna's kidnapping Rukmini, there was initially some misunderstanding between the two families. But Bhishmaka, king of Vidarbha, being approached by Sri Balaram, persuaded by many saintly persons, was induced to participate in the marriage ceremony of Krishna and Rukmini. Although the incident of the kidnapping was not a very happy occurrence in the kingdom of Vidarbha, kidnapping was not an unusual affair among Kshatriyas. Kidnapping was, in fact, current in almost all marriages. Anyway, King Bhishmaka was from the very beginning inclined to hand over his beautiful daughter to Krishna. In one way or another, his purpose had been served, and so he was pleased to join the marriage ceremony, even though his eldest son was degraded in the fight. It is mentioned in the Padma Purana that Maharaj Nanda and the coward boys of Vrindavan joined the marriage ceremony. Of course, the mood is very much different. Dwarka and Vrindavan. Krishna is worshipped in Dwarka as a king, and the mood there is awe and reverence. That's why Krishna married 16,108 princesses and established a palace for each one of them. So all the inhabitants of Yadupuri, Dwarka, could worship Krishna in that mood of awe and reverence. But of course the mood in Vrindavan is very much different. There's no awe and reverence, but there's the intimacy of love. But somehow or other it appears that the cowherd boys of Vrindavan, they joined in the marriage ceremony with Nanda Maharaj. But later on, we learned from Srimad Bhagavatam that there was a solar eclipse, and at that solar eclipse, everyone assembled at the auspicious place of the Kurukshetra. Kurukshetra has been auspicious. It's been we think of it as a battlefield, but actually Kurukshetra was traditionally a place of sacrifice. It's a very holy place. And for thousands of years, saintly persons had come there at auspicious times to perform sacrifices, also at inauspicious time to take shelter there during auspicious, like eclipses are, we were discussing today, eclipses are very inauspicious, so devotees bathe in the Ganges or take shelter at some holy place so as not to be affected by the eclipse. But we know, of course, Kurukshetra more for it as the battlefield between the two armies, the Pandavas and the Kurus. But even there it is mentioned that Dhritarashtra, he was in some anxiety because he knew the battle was to take place at Kurukshetra. And why was he in anxiety? Because he knew that the Pandus were righteous and his sons were not righteous, they were irreligious. So probably the effect of that auspicious place would favor the Pandavas. So he was in anxiety, that's mentioned in the very beginning of the Bhagavad Gita. Anyway, so later, these different personalities assembled there at Kurukshetra. And at that time, the gopis, who had been feeling such separation from Krishna for so many years, because Krishna had actually promised them that he would come back in a few days, but he didn't keep his promise. Of course, he didn't keep his promise because he knew that the gopis were feeling the highest love through Vipalamba Seva, through separation. That has been described by our Gaudiya Vaishnava Sampradaya as the highest method of worshipping Krishna, because in Krishna's presence, of course, there's some interaction, but in separation, so many thoughts, so many feelings, so many moods, so many rasas are going through one's mind simultaneously. So one's thoughts of Krishna are actually, emotions for Krishna are increased a thousandfold in Vipalamba Seva. So although Krishna had promised to come back, the next day he went to Mathura, he killed Kamsa, and of course then he began to fight with Jarasandha, because just after killing Kamsa, Jarasandha attacked Mathura 17 times and he was defeated. But then on the 17th battle, Krishna received a letter from Rukmini that she was to be married to Shishupal. So Krishna became Ranchur. He left the battlefield showing his supreme opulence of renunciation. Wasn't attached to name and fame, but he was more attached to his devotees. So he left the battlefield to kidnap Rukmini and take her to Dwarka. So then later on, we'll read about the solar eclipse at Kurukshetra. And there the gopis, they had, after a very long time, the chance to see their Krishna. But it's described that when the gopis came there, Krishna was not like he was before. Before he was a simple cowherd boy. But here he appeared to be very regal, and no longer was he decorated with the flowers of the forest and the trees and the bushes and the dust from Vrindavan, but rather he was appearing as a king, dressed in very stately robes and battle dress, etc. And he was worshipped by awe and reverence by the other inhabitants of Dwarka. So actually it's described the gopis felt very uncomfortable. They didn't really want to see Krishna like that. It caused them some disturbance to see him like that. And they were praying. There's actually a very famous verse by Radharani. I don't remember it, but she's praying, I long for those days when we were in Vrindavan, the banks of the Jamuna, and you know, you were the little Krishna and I was Radharani, and I'm longing for that. So she was begging, please come back to Vrindavan. So Krishna agreed to go. And that ceremony of taking Krishna back to Vrindavan after such a long time to resume his role as the son of Nanda Maharaj and of Mother Yasoda. That's the Ratha Yatra festival. Krishna, Balaram, and Subhadra, after long separation from Vrindavan, they're going back. So that's the internal meaning of the Ratha Yatra. Of course, Ratha Yatra also gives the conditioned souls an opportunity to see the beautiful face of Lord Jagannath and become purified. But the internal meaning is that. And that we actually see in the pastimes of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, who appeared in the mood of Radharani. So on the plea of Radharani and the gopis, Krishna agreed to go back to Vrindavan. That mood was pulling him back. So therefore, during the Ratha Yatra ceremony, when Chaitanya Mahaprabhu was present 500 years ago, Jagannath Krishna, he was being pulled by Chaitanya Mahaprabhu and his devotees. And as long as Lord Jagannath could see the transcendental dancing of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, who was actually exhibiting his ecstatic love, just as Radharani, she experiences Mahabhava, the topmost love for the Lord. So that was manifest in the ecstatic symptoms of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. As long as Lord Jagannath could see Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, the cart would go forward. But if for a moment Chaitanya Mahaprabhu happened to disappear in the crowd of devotees and perhaps go out of the vision of the Ratha Yatra, then immediately the cart would stop and Krishna wouldn't go any further. He couldn't be drawn. And Mahaprabhu would appear again and the cart would go. In this way, Krishna went back to Vrindavan. It is mentioned in the Padma Purana that Maharaj Nanda, the coward boys of Vrindavan, joined the marriage ceremony. Kings from the kingdoms of Kuru, Srinjaya, Kekaya, Vidarbha, and Kunti came to Dwarka on this occasion with all their royal paraphernalia. The story of Rukmini's being kidnapped by Krishna was poeticized, and professional readers recited it everywhere. All the assembled kings and their daughters especially were struck with wonder and very pleased upon hearing the frivolous activities of Krishna. In this way, all the visitors, as well as the inhabitants of Dwarka city, were joyful to see Krishna and Rukmini together. In other words, the Supreme Lord, the maintainer of everyone, and the Goddess of Fortune were united, and all the people felt extremely jubilant. Thus ends the Bhaktivedanta Purport, 53rd chapter of Krishna. Krishna defeats all the princes and takes Rukmini home to Dwarka. Shri Prabhupada ki.
Jai.
Shri Prabhupada ki. Jai. So Prahlad will lead us in a bhajan, which we've entitled Dwarka Separation in Poland. This is what we